Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guests today are Vernon Everett, Managing Director of Customers, Communication and Technology at the Transport for London, and Jonathan Bray, Director of Urban Transport Group, which is the membership organisation for the country's big city region transport authorities. The issue we're going to explore today is whether the country's big city regions are moving towards or away from having more integrated transport systems. And to guide us through this question, we're going to use the recent report produced by the UTG, Number Crunch, Transport Trends in the City Regions, which sets out the travel patterns of the past decade and projected future trends. It's a great report, jam-packed, full of facts and figures, definitely worth a read, and we'll put a link up to the report on our website. So let me start by reading a quote from Torben Hughes, who's the chair of the Urban Transport Group, when he was referring to the report. And I quote, "The pace of urban transport has changed dramatically over the last decade. And given the pace of social and technological change and the ambitions of new entrants to the UK's urban transport scene, we can expect further sweeping shifts in the coming decade. The growth and decline of different transport modes has major knock-on effects for a host of transport and wider urban public policy goals such as social and economic inclusion, congestion and air quality. We therefore need stronger, more coordinated and integrated transport planning in urban areas if our cities are to thrive." So big, bold statement, lots of change and lots to do. So before we get into the context, for the sake of listeners, Vernon, just give us a sense as to when we say integrated urban planning, urban transport systems, what do we mean? You know, in a sense, what does that mean to you?
I think, well, what it means to us is joining up public transport and the roads to try and deliver to our customers. And I use the word customer deliberately. That's people that use the road network as well as people that pay a fare for public transport. But to pull all of that together so that the journeys are as seamless as possible. Because I think if you're a user of public transport, for example, you don't particularly care which logo is on the side of the vehicle. You're going somewhere, you're going to work, you're going to hospital, you're going you're going shopping, and you just want to get there in as convenient a way as you possibly can. So I think one of the things that we see about making this happen is, particularly in the light of the rapid population growth that there's been, particularly in London. I mean, London is the biggest that it's ever been, and it was only last this big at the end of the 1930s, is to enable that seamless journey making. And that is a combination of running frequent and reliable services, obviously, providing value for money so that people can actually afford to use your services, and to introduce things like joined up integrated ticketing and information to bind all of that lot together. So I think that they're the key ingredients for us, and you know, we're lucky enough to have had sort of an 18-year run at this now. After the advent of the mayoralty in London, and we've learned a lot along the way. They're the key ingredients.
Great. Well, we'll pick up on all of the, most of those aspects, hopefully, in the conversation. John, anything to add, just in terms of just getting the definition and understanding of, you know, integrated urban transport systems? What, you know, anything to add in terms of what Vernon has just said?
Well, I think for the city regions outside London, integration is something they haven't had enough of. I think it's quite an unusual situation for European cities or cities in developed countries where you've got city regions that don't really have control over their local public transport system in operationally or in a planning and strategic way. And this is mainly due to bus deregulation that happened in the 80s and is still there. So you may not believe it, but if you wanted to start a bus service into the centre of Manchester using just about whatever vehicle you wanted and charge whatever you want, you could do. Not many people do because the incumbents would soon see you off, but you could do. Integration is something that city regions outside London see in London and would like more of. I think we are making some progress in that we fought long and hard to get some more effective legislation on buses. We've got the Buses Act 2017. It's not perfect, it's not an easy process, but it's a damn sight better than what was there before.
Yeah.
We've seen devolution on rail to a certain extent. So we've got some of the elements, it's kind of so near but yet so far. And then at the same time, I think what's happening in terms of integration is that new things are now happening. You're getting waves of new transport services coming in, which have all sorts of implications. The first wave was Uber and the like, enormous growth in PHVs. Second wave, dockless bikes. Third wave, we don't know. But it will come,
yeah,
and it will be as significant as the other two. And how do you factor that in, or do you not factor that into the integration that people want in terms of one network, one system, one set of ticketing across public transport?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we'll come back to those sort of questions in a little while. Let's just use the way that you talked about the travel patterns and trends that in number crunch, just to explore across our big city regions, you know, what's happening in terms of those kind of modes of transport. And you start us off, John, to give us a sense, and then I'm quite interested, similar, different in London for the reasons that we know about. So let's do buses first. So nationally, 70% of all public transport journeys were made during the bus in 2016-17, says the report. How does that, what's the overall trend and pattern across our city regions over the last 10 years or so, Jonathan?
Well, buses have been one of the big losers of the last 10 years, and indeed they've been the big losers for quite a long period before that in the city regions outside London. So lost about 10% of passengers in the last 10 years alone. 16% of services have disappeared. 16%, that's quite a lot if you think about it in terms of the kind of routes that have gone. And fares have gone up by 28% in real terms. So we've seen this. There's long-term decline on bus. I think there are a whole series of factors that could be behind that. Vernon could talk a bit more about the London example, but clearly we talked about deregulation earlier. That hasn't helped.
Yeah.
We've got the fact that motoring can be very competitive, where you've got fares going up on bus. You've got social attitudes on bus as well.
Yeah.
I think you've got a whole series of people who really wouldn't think about bus travel because of the way they perceive it socially. So there's a huge amount of challenges around the bus. But it's important that we turn that round, because buses relied upon by the poorest in our communities. We can't run an effective public transport network without a healthy bus service. If you want to open up new housing opportunities, new development opportunities, the bus is the easiest way to do that, because rail takes time.
Yeah.
So it's been one of the forgotten elements of the public transport system, and it's been in continual decline. That's why we were so desperate to get some better powers to deliver improvements, alongside the other things that will need to happen to get more patronage on bus. But perhaps Vernon's a better place, because London has a much better story to tell on bus and the longer run.
Yeah, and the arc is different, isn't it? If you look back 1980s, from the 1980s through, we've had a huge increase in ridership on buses.
Yes.
And then...
Well, I mean, if you think about the journey in London post-war, there really wasn't much investment in transport. And I'm unfortunately old enough to remember the years, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, where London's transport network was really struggling through a lack of investment. And things like investing in a very high frequency bus network, such that you don't even need a timetable, you just know that they're going to turn up every 5 to 7 minutes, revolutionised the bus service in London. And it's the workhorse of London's transport network. And we've seen growth in ridership for best part of a decade. The last 2 years or so, we saw that coming off a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that was mainly, our analysis of that is mainly because there was an enormous amount going on the road network, which was affecting bus journey time reliability. Mm-hmm. So we were, for example, reallocating road space for cycling lanes, for example, and while that work went on, some bits of the bus service were affected by that, and so, you know, people chose other modes or walked, and you, with our real-time information now, you know that you don't have to wait for the bus. You know, you look at your app, and you see it's a bit longer away than you're anticipating, so you walk.
Yes, you walk.
But what we've seen now, having got over that, is that the bus service is the most reliable that it's ever been, and we're starting to see that dip sort of recover. It's certainly plateaued and starting to recover. On the tube,
we'll come to the tube in a second. So right. Just to,
the other thing, sorry, yeah, go on before on the I lose my train of thought, one other thing I should add, because Jonathan mentioned fares. One of the other things that has been huge for us is the concessionary fare schemes, where children and those over 60 travel for free of charge. The mayor has introduced new fare types. So we have the bus hopper fare, which means that you can now make unlimited journeys within an hour on the buses and trams for £1.50. Now, that's really big, because to Jonathan's point about people, about the affordability of the network, that has been a huge initiative, and has played a part, we think, in generating more trips.
Yeah. And concessionary fares seem to be under threat, given reductions in budgets elsewhere, and so concessionary fare in, I'm not so much in London, but outside of London, is that right?
It's a national legal requirement for every local authority to fund the free off-peak concessionary fares for older and disabled people. And that brings a bit of cost, but also many benefits. Mm. There are real benefits of getting people active and mobile out in the community and spending money in the community. So there are benefits to that. I think the challenge, though, is that for younger people, there is no legal requirement to provide any kind of concession. And the revenue cuts for local transport authorities therefore have fallen onto young people's concessions, but also onto bus services per se.
Yeah.
So then you get the problem of some older people having a pass, but no service to use it on.
Yeah.
So and it also creates that the bus market outside London is rather distorted.
Yeah.
Because ostensibly it's a deregulated free market, but actually the state, local state, national state is paying a lot of people to travel on it for free.
For free.
Easier to manage in a contracted system like London, and also to add in other contracted concessions for young people.
Yeah.
Because I think young people have been some of the losers over the last 10 years, I think, on transport, because they don't have that concession. They tend to be, they don't drive, obviously, heavily dependent on bus services.
Yeah.
I think there's been a little bit of a change around. I think there's more voluntary schemes come in, commitments by mayors and apprenticeships. Mm-hmm. The government's looking at apprenticeships at the moment.
Yeah.
But I do think there's a need to step back a little bit and look at how we manage buses, because you could get you're getting a situation where fares for regular passengers get very uncompetitive, very high, partly because the operators are reimbursed for carrying older people in the proportion of the adult fare. So the higher the adult fare, the more money you get for carrying free passengers.
Yeah.
So that can distort the market.
Yeah.
And when you get to a situation where it's cheaper to take a cab than it is for two people to travel together on the bus, that's got to be a factor.
That's got to be a factor
in why bus patronage is declining, especially when a lot of people actually don't really like the bus product for various reasons.
Yeah.
So it needs some unbundling and untangling so that we get that fares mix right, including the concessions.
Okay.
And that's another benefit, of course, for London, that we, can, or the mayor, sets the fares.
Yes.
So that's another way in which you can sort of bring this integration into the network. He doesn't set all fares, of course.
No.
We've done certain for the Overground Rail network and so on, but for a big part of London's network, we also have that ability, which is hugely beneficial.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to rail, John. What's been happening? I know the data doesn't quite work always, but there's some interesting data in the report, nevertheless. So we'll talk about rail, and then we'll move on to tram and underground. So we'll come back to those. But just give us where we are in rail.
I think rail has been one of the big winners of the decade. Yeah. I mean, we've seen patronage on regional rail services, which includes the big cities, go up by a third. Seen similar figures in the southeast. We've seen increases in the big cities. There's now more people go into central Birmingham by train than by car.
I saw those numbers. So Birmingham New Street has seen growth into the rail use of 169% over a 10-year period. Leeds, 71%. Liverpool Lime Street, 139%. and London Euston 63% increase.
Yeah. And what's interesting as well is you're also getting some big growth into places like Huddersfield, 1%. Newton and the Willows, 120%, Rochdale, 81%. So it's not, some of that will be going to the big cities, but it's interesting what's going on. And I think what's happening is that rail is benefiting from its intrinsic advantage, which is it gets you into the centre of cities rapidly.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people may not necessarily enjoy the commuter rail experience, and they complain about it, but it ain't stopping them from piling on the trains because of that intrinsic advantage that rail has. And I think the long-term prospects for rail are very strong, because if you look at where cities want to be, they want to be denser.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's an argument Centre for Cities talks about. At the same time, all the cities are trying to reduce traffic in the city centres to cut air pollution, to create more attractive environments for people to spend time in. And we also need to open up housing sites, and where are the brownfield sites off the next to railway lines? And it's hard to see how you can achieve any of these goals without putting more into rail.
Yeah.
So I think at the moment, and Vernon may have something to say about it, that we've seen a softening of demand. We've also seen season ticket use go down quite a lot. And I suspect that's partly connected to some long-run social trends, which are, I think, you're getting more people not working full-time, you're getting more people working from home more often. Some people say that Thursday is the new Friday because people are working from home on Friday.
Yeah.
I think younger people, I think there's a certain, some of us still have this kind of work ethic around, you know, work is about suffering. So you suffer your commute, you go in the office and, you know, you earn it. I think a lot of younger people are going, I'm not buying into that. This is my life and I'd rather work at home, thank you, than cram on the commute train.
Yeah.
So I think some of these longer term trends are playing in, but I still think rail has some incredible strengths that will continue to contribute.
Yeah. So, Bernard, what's the story around? It's a London and a South East, really, given the nature of the rail system and how it functions in and out of London.
So where is the bus network ridership is driven more like by the population of London, the rail network is a function of its economy.
Yeah.
And is largely driven by its economy. And what we've seen, actually, is the sort of peak time commuting traffic, if you like, holding up pretty strongly. What we have seen is some tail off in off-peak travel, which we think is largely a function of the economic environment. So when people are feeling that wages are being squeezed or incomes are being squeezed, and we've had a long period where inflation has been outstripping wage growth and so on.
Indeed.
Making those discretionary trips does, you know, become more discretionary.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have seen a bit of a tail off in that, but we're still seeing, as I say, we're still seeing very strong growth and strong demand during the peak hours. And in London, of course, we don't run all of the heavy rail services into London. A number of them have been devolved to us, and in fact in 2007 the government devolved the London Overground to us, which has been a fabulous success, a real example of where a bit of investment and staff on stations at all time and being able to use integrated tickets has stimulated a whole bunch of journeys that wouldn't otherwise have been there. And it's like a little M25, a mini M25 around London, but on rails.
Yeah.
And it's been fantastically successful. And we're in discussion with the government about the possibility of the devolution of more suburban rail services. In fact, they've suggested some of the ones that might come within this. And I think that all goes back to our core theme in this conversation. Mm. That's driving further integration. You know, we're optimistic, and while we might have, as you always do in economic cycles, a bit of buffeting along the way, the long-term trajectory is up.
Yeah.
And you know, on current assumptions, London goes from 8.8 million to over 10 in the early 2030s. Mm. So you can't afford to sort of sit back and say, well, it's coming off a little bit, you don't need to invest in
it. No.
Quite the reverse.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move to what you call, in the report it's referred to as mass transit and modern, so tram and underground, as I understand it, Jonathan. So we'll get Vernon in a second on the underground, but light rail or tram, that includes Docklands Light Railway, also includes Manchester Metrolink, Nottingham Express Transit, Tyne and Wear Metro actually. What's been going on that sort of light rail scenario? Patronage up, ridership up over time?
Yeah, I think it's been a good decade for light rail and tram, partly because we're seeing some proper networks now. It used to be, we've got the odd line here and there, come and look at our curiosity.
Yeah.
But you go to Manchester now, and there's trams buzzing past you all over the place.
Indeed.
Two routes through the centre of Manchester because one route wasn't enough. We've seen the Docklands Light Railway continue to expand. And I think people respond, so you're seeing patronage growth there. I think people like trams and light rail because it provides that certainty of the journey. You know where the thing is going. It doesn't have a doubt. You sometimes get a bus use. But also when trams are done right, it can be part of a wider transformation of the city urban realm.
Yeah.
And also a city's sense of itself. So Manchester is associated with its trams. Tyne and Wear Metro, the Metro M symbol, is one of the top symbols for recognition and association.
Okay. Yeah.
And of course, I don't really need to say too much about the Transport for London and what that means to London. It's impossible to imagine about.
Yeah,
so I think we're getting there on light rail. I think there's more to be done. If you go to French and German cities, you'll see more trams in small cities sometimes. Mm. So there's more to be done, but it is a success story. People like it, particularly when it's matched to the changing land use patterns where development is located, where you get the park and ride right from the start.
Yeah.
And I think Nottingham is a great example of that. They've got the park and ride in there. In the right way at the start. So Nottingham is a great example, and Tyne as well, so their workplace parking.
Okay. So anything on tram, but then obviously just tell us the story about the underground over the period.
Well, on trams, we have our own tram network, of course, and just going back to Jonathan's point about trams really being a very community based. Mm. Thing, it's absolutely true here.
People do love
the
a tram,
Croydon,
don't they?
The Croydon area, because it is, the tram network as an integral part of their local community.
Yeah.
It's just part of the way of life. And it's been hugely, hugely, hugely successful. I've always envied Birmingham's tram network, though, because they've got a tram called Ozzy Osbourne. But on the London Underground, it's a similar story, really, to heavy rail. A buoyant growth over a period, come off a little bit over the last year or so, mainly again off-peak discretionary trips, but we've seen that recover somewhat during this year. And there's a huge amount of investment. I mean, we often, John, talk about investment around the country, don't we? One of the things about the London Underground is you have to invest in your existing capacity. And so while there are some unbelievable things coming down the track, like the launch of Crossrail in December, which is a complete game changer for London, we're also investing heavily, however, in our existing assets to get the digital railway, which is currently running the Victoria Line, the Northern Line, the Jubilee Line, onto other tube lines, because you instantly get more capacity out of that as well by leveraging these modern technological feats. I mean, some people talk about digital railways. We've actually got it in London on those upgraded lines.
Really nice.
So we're anticipating a little bit a flat trajectory on the underground during the course of the next year, 18 months, purely because more people will start using the Elizabeth line.
Yes.
When it comes, and that will actually relieve some of the biggest congestion points on the London Underground network, particularly on the central and northern lines.
And it's worth saying, I mean, that you've got the numbers in the report, Jonathan. You know, on the underground in 2016-17, 1.4 billion trips Yeah. I mean, 1.4 billion. I mean, it's, the numbers are, you know, so staggering.
It is staggering. And actually, I don't know if you remember, during the Olympics, we proudly put a press release out one day saying we've carried more people today than we've ever carried. It was just over 4.2 million. We're doing that every day now. So, you know, such has been the growth.
Yeah, no, absolutely so, right. Yeah. I find it incredible. Okay, let's go to cars and vans. Jonathan, what's going on at the, you know, at the overall sort of trend level on cars and vans?
Well, cars are still dominating trips nationally, and sometimes when you're in city centres, you can sometimes forget that. But in cities, London being a great example of that, but elsewhere too, its dominance is being reduced. Mm. But I think there's some interesting sub-trends. What you're seeing is younger people moving away from driving licence take-up and driving less frequently. So in the early 90s, it peaked with 48% of 17 to 20-year-olds having a driving licence. And now that is down to 29%. So some quite significant changes among young people. How they are travelling now is perhaps something we need to investigate further. I think some of them are going towards some of the demand responsive options, the PHVs, the taxis. And also, young people, probably like the rest of us, travelling less because people are now doing more from home, working, leisure, socialising. What's also happening, at the same time as young people are moving away from the car, older people are moving towards it at a faster rate.
At a faster rate. Yeah, I think that's quite interesting, isn't it? So overall, more driving licences, but actually that's because the older, you know, the older cohorts have taken it up. And they've more than made up for the numbers that we've dropped on the younger cohorts.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things when we were doing this report was one of the things that occurred to me that we just haven't focused on enough, perhaps, is the big demographic shift. Mm. So cities are growing, but they're getting older.
Yeah.
So the over 75 population will grow by 80% by 2039. Now, it would be a mistake to stereotype all older people as the roadsides tend to do, as people who are elderly and infirm. A lot of older people will be healthier than those who are still at work because they won't be sat behind the desk eating rubbish all day doing their exercise. So, and we can see as well what's happening because they have a free bus pass, but they're not using it as much as they used to do.
No, quite, yeah.
And some of the same reasons why other people have moved away from the bus, certainly outside London, because they don't like the product. So I think it's something that we need to perhaps give more attention to about this a society that's getting older, because it's going to have all sorts of implications, and the car ownership more than car use is just one of them.
Yeah. Well, what's happening in London? I mean, and interesting if you've got any thought on the, you know, the congestion zone area and, you know, whether how that's playing out over time.
Yeah. Well, I think it's an inner London story, an inner and central London story, and an outer London story.
Yeah.
So in inner and central London, we have seen a significant reduction in vehicles, but in outer London, that's still the dominant form of transport. Yeah. And very often, you know, people often think about London and public transport being ubiquitous. It isn't in certain parts of outer London, where the bus services aren't that frequent and the rail services aren't that frequent either. So again, I think on road traffic, again, that tends to be a function of the economy. We have seen a reduction in central London. We've seen a reduction in the number, the light van traffic in central London. And we think some of that is because of the initiatives that we've been taking forward with the freight industry and their customers to try and consolidate freight and to try and cut back and maybe travel more off peak to deliver the goods and services that you need to do it, you need to deliver to support a growing city. The mayor has just published his revised transport strategy in London, and that has a target of moving to 80% of all journeys being done by public transport, walking and cycling by the early 2040s. That currently stands at 64%.
Okay.
And what we really want to do is increase the attractiveness of public transport, walking and cycling, so that we can encourage more people to leave the car at home or to use some of those other modes of transport as part of their journey.
Yeah, and we can come onto this in a once we've got kind of gone through the modes, John, but just the market, you know, in the sense of that question about, you know, how places outside of London shift the usage away from private towards public. And we're always interested here, you know, the centre for cities about, you know, the mix of carrots and sticks, you know, the degree to which you can make the alternatives more attractive, but also, you know, you might need to make the current usage less attractive. But we can come on to those sorts of things in a minute. Let's move to taxis and private hire vehicles, which are different things. We've seen an enormous increase. I mean, a fantastic statistic, again, from the report, is the numbers of taxis in London has decreased over the last 10 years, whilst the number of private hire vehicles has increased by almost 100%. London now has one private hire vehicle for every 100 people. And the similar number, or the equivalent comparison in South Yorkshire, I think, is three private hire vehicles for every 1,000 people. So, an enormous explosion of taxis and, well, particularly private hire vehicles. Is that the story across our city regions?
I mean, it is happening. London's most marked. But if you look at the West Midlands, we saw an increase in licensed PHVs of 45% in just 2 years alone, which is quite remarkable. Mm. And I think, as I was saying earlier, I think the PHVs are the example of what happens when you get new technologies, new business models, unlimited reserves of private venture capital, and a very sticky and attractive targeted consumer offer. So these companies are not trying to do anything else, not trying to do anything wider than get the more people using their services, particularly PHV's services.
Yeah.
And you can see how rapid that transformation is. And if you go to any of our cities, you can see with your own eyes in the streets, you just see the number of Ubers going past you on the pavement.
And the city region second to London in terms of increase of private hire vehicles over that period is Merseyside, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I think it creates all sorts of interesting challenges because PHVs are a big employer now, and particularly for some communities, there's a very high proportion of Pakistani males are PHV drivers, so there's all sorts of issues around employment and inclusion. There's issues around safety and security, public safety, some horrible crime incidents in some of our cities which were rooted in the PHV trade. You've got issues around congestion, you've got issues around air quality, you've got issues around technology, with some of the big global conglomerates seeing taxis as the place where they can introduce autonomous vehicles first, from driven taxis to taxi bots. So it's a fascinating area, and I think it also shows how the job of transport authorities has got harder but more interesting.
Because
if you, everyone wants a cheap taxi, and some of these large companies are providing very cheap taxis because they're not charging what it costs to provide them. But if everyone gets a cheap taxi, none of those cheap taxis can move because the road is full of cheap taxis. Only city transport authorities can take that decision to balance the consumer benefit with keeping cities moving. The challenge is particularly acute because the national legislation is totally unfit for purpose. If you look at our city regions as well, we've still got taxi licensing at the district level rather than city region level. So there's a whole series of challenges there.
So we're the regulator for the taxi and private hire industry in London. But I was just about to make Jonathan's point, actually, that the regulatory framework is fragmented and very difficult. And we would, for example, like to be able to limit the growth in private hire vehicles, but we have no ability to do that. So it's a question of balance, I guess. I think some of what we were talking about in terms of car ownership is quite interesting in this context, though, because some of those younger people that might have a greater propensity to use one of the private hire vehicles that Jonathan was talking about may not buy a car as a result.
Yeah.
And so you just have to look at this in the round, and particularly in outer, I'll make the outer London point again, we've seen big growth in private hire in those areas as well, which has sort of mitigated to some extent the absence or the ubiquity of public transport that you find elsewhere in central and inner London.
And does, I mean, you give us a reflection, you know, does this growth and this pattern of, you know, choice that people are making and then their kind of response, does it make it harder to move towards this integrated sort of transport? Because that, for me, you tell me otherwise, but, you know, for, as an outside observer, it seems to me to be this is the one trend where, you know, it potentially pulls in the opposite direction of trying to provide, you know, a more integrated system. But, you know, you tell me differently in terms of, you know, what the position is.
I think authorities have to be a number of things. You don't have to operate everything.
Yeah.
We are an operator. We're a regulator.
Yeah.
We're an integrator. We have a payment platform. And all of those things, all of those levers are available to us to be able to sort of brigade under an overarching mayor's transport strategy, the sorts of outcomes that we need to make the city sustainable.
Mm.
And they go beyond just moving people around. They also go towards things like air quality, which is a massive issue, particularly for London. So, you know, I think it's it makes life more interesting, as Jonathan said earlier on, and you just have to remember which hat you're wearing when you're actually looking at what's developing.
Yeah. Okay. Let's do the last sort of mode or segment, which is active travel trends, which for the everyday person is walking and cycling. So. The trends around walking and cycling across our city regions, and again, we'll get some reflections again, because I think there are some particularities around the London context. Again, interesting, in 1975, walking accounted for 47% of all trips made. In 2016, that number was 25%. It's kind of interesting sort of decline. We're walking much less, but still a very big mode of transport or travel. Jonathan?
Yeah, still a big player, but I think the national statistics are pretty depressing. Cycling's bobbling along at very low levels. Walking, as you were saying, has been declining over time. However, and this is where Vernon will come in, if you build it, they will come. And certainly that's what London has shown in terms of active travel. So we've seen 50% growth in cycling in the last decade in London because London invested in it. And what's interesting as well, if you look nationally, that only 27% of people are either very or fairly satisfied with cycling and walking facilities, compared to 43% for local roads, 53% for trains.
Interesting.
So the facilities that people have are not there. I think what you might see in city centres, and you're seeing it at the moment, is that there is a big move towards creating better environments for walking and cycling, but that's associated with people wanting to have more attractive places. I think what's happening in city centres, at least, is that the placemakers are driving transport policy, not the other way around, because the placemakers say, no, we want this square to be free of traffic, and transport has to respond to that.
Okay.
And I think the last thing I'll say is that the danger, I think, is we get a kind of, and we've been talking a little bit about it earlier, is you get a big dichotomy between the core city centres, which will look as wonderful and beautiful as other city centres in European cities, because everyone's doing the same thing with their bike hire and their urban rail.
Yeah.
And as you go further out, you're going back into the 80s, because it's all about cars and big sheds, and it's all being sustained as well by a huge programme of interurban road building that the government is pursuing. So you've almost got the danger of a kind of throwback, very car dependent, all investment in roads.
Yeah.
Outside the cities, and as you get further into the city centres, you get this lovely thing that we all aspire to.
Yeah.
So I think that's one potential
interesting
trend we may see.
Brilliant. Interesting your thought, to pick up this Jonathan point about the relationship between increasing in cycling and the provision of cycling infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
and your thought on did we see a rise in cycling and then the infrastructure came on the back of that, or did we put the infrastructure in and we, I'm sure there's a bit of there's a bit of both going on there, but I was always curious as to
so cycling was growing before the segregated lanes that people familiar with now were put in, and before the cycle high scheme came in, because we introduced one of those too. But it really has taken off as a result of the introduction of the segregated cycle lanes.
Yeah.
And at peak time in central London, more bicycles are flowing over the bridges from one side to the other than any other form of vehicle. Mm. So we've seen a huge boom in cycling, and that really is down to the fact that we are taking steps to make that safer, but we want more of it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Again, I come back to the big, you know, the big objective of 80% of people using public transport, walking and cycling. There's still an enormous amount of work to do to get there. And on the walking side of things, on both the cycling and the walking side of things, the Mayor's transport strategy is founded on a concept of healthy streets.
Yeah.
So as Jonathan was saying, if you create nice places where people want to spend time, you're likelier to get people who will get there, who will walk around the corner and go there, or get on a bicycle and go there. And with walking in particular, you know, people are becoming more health conscious, and integrating some part of walking into your journey, even if it's to a public transport hub, you know, is something that we would like to encourage more. Mm. We'd like to encourage more school children to walk to school. Mm. So we want more of everything, really.
Yeah.
You know, and all the market for this, we believe, are people that are currently using their cars. And the trick, I think, is to give people viable options to be able to take a more sustainable mode.
Yeah, okay, excellent. So we've got our sort of trends, and then we've talked a little bit about some of the factors that have been underpinning some of the trends that we've seen. You know, and obviously there are questions about, you know, the economic growth of our big city regions. That's been a story of the last decade, in the sense economic growth drives a desire for and a demand for more travel, you know, in most instances. We've seen population growth over the recent period, and we see projected population growth over the next 10 years. So there's kind of underlying demand factors that we think are, you know, have been affecting the travel patterns in the way that we've seen it. But I'd be interested to get your thoughts on, maybe Vernon, you start with, you know, the role that, you talked about it earlier on, the role that, you know, pricing systems, you know, where they're much more responsive to different times of travel. You know, the heavy investment from TfL in ticketing, you know, going from, you know, ticketing to Oyster now to, you know, to contactless. And what's that done for the system? And then, because I think there's this, other places are doing some of this, but not quite in the same comprehensive way. But that's where we're trying to get to. So just give us a sense as to how you think those sorts of innovations have affected, you know, the way that people are using the transport system.
Yeah, well, Oyster's been a complete game changer for London. And this might not be the answer for every city around the country, but nevertheless, 2003, when it was brought in, it revolutionised things, because people could just tap and go. Mm. And you could, you could actually rely on the right fare being charged and all that. And we had peak and off peak. But you didn't have to work hard to work it out. You just tapped and went. Actually, the people that introduced Oyster were starting to think about contactless not that long after Oyster was introduced.
Yeah.
Because that seemed to be the next evolution. Now, why do you ask people to convert their currency into transport currency? Yeah. Why don't you just use your bank card in the same way as when you're buying your shopping or whatever it happens to be, to make your journeys? And now over 50% of our pay-as-you-go journeys are now made by contactless payment. That's either a bank card or a mobile phone, something like that. And that's done a number of things. That we believe that that's generated more ridership.
Yeah.
Because it just,
so it's not just made it easier, it's actually brought new customers, passengers onto the system.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We think there's firm evidence that there's been an additional generated trips as simply as a result of making life easier for people to use the system.
Yeah.
and to be confident. Like the other key ingredient with Oyster is to have a daily cap.
Yeah.
Because people do criticise the fares in London for being expensive, but one of the things maybe we don't communicate well enough is that you're capped. So after a number of journeys, you can travel for the rest of the day for nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So value for money comes into it as well. But it's done a couple of things. It's generated trips, but it's also almost halved our cost of revenue collection. So it's been a huge boon. And we've now, with contactless payment, we've now licensed the contactless payment solution to New York and to Boston.
Yeah.
So their cities will be benefiting from that as well. So integration of ticketing, and alongside that, I'd put information. I don't know if you want to come on to that.
Say that in there, because I think get Jonathan to reflect on where we are outside of that.
I would just say that ubiquity of travel information is the other thing that I'll put alongside the integration of ticketing.
Yeah.
As soon as you let people know what is going on around them in the form they want to consume it. So we have an open data policy at TfL. So we have a single API where we pump out the location of tubes, buses, riverboats, the stock in cycle hire docking stations, you name it, it's out there. And that's enabled, over 40%, 42% of Londoners are using apps that are powered by that free open data, which just gives them choice. And it enables them to understand when the next bus is coming, and you don't have to leave your house. You know, before you know when to leave, they have to go to the bus stop and so on. So we think that that's been a complete game changer as well. And we had some independent analysis done actually by Deloitte, who reckoned that the free open data strategy contributes about £130 million into the London economy every year by dint of saving people time.
Interesting. Yeah.
And if you can then move it on to using that information provision to inform people about better options for them.
Yeah.
So we've used some of our data, and you know, notwithstanding Facebook and GDPR and all the rest of it, one of the things that we've been there are several barriers between us and any notion that we would give our data away on individuals. We never do that.
No.
And our ticketing system is a fortress built around it. But nevertheless, some of the aggregate level data that you get out of it is really helpful, because you can look at how people are actually using the system. What pings of mobile phones to our Wi-Fi detectors on station platforms give you a pattern of how people are using the system when they're getting in.
Yeah.
Because the ticketing system tells you when they enter and exit.
Yeah, but not what they're doing around.
But what we did a trial on this, and what it showed that was the journey pairs between King's Cross and Waterloo. There were about 40 of them. We thought, well, why are people doing that? And we were able to work it out, and we were able actually to nudge people to interchange at some of the busiest stations where they simply didn't need to interchange.
Yeah.
There was a better journey elsewhere.
Yeah.
So this stuff is just. There's a lot said about data, and there's a lot of stuff that feels a bit far-fetched to me.
Yeah. And do you think
we've got real evidence of where it can actually make a practical benefit, a practical difference?
And before I go to John, just a sense of, you know, how far into this agenda do you feel that, you know, are we at the beginnings? Yeah. Obviously you've made good strides, but in a sense, do you see there's much more to come?
Yeah. And I think, particularly on the road network, where we've got a lot more data that we would like to liberate on the road network. We do that. We already work in partnership with apps like Waze and others to, you know, try and make sure people don't run out of petrol in the Blackwall Tunnel things like that, which is really inconvenient and costs the London economy an awful lot of money every time it happens. I think we're scratching the surface. Yeah. But you have to be a bit careful, because you have to ask the right exam question of your data. Otherwise, it can all get terribly interesting, but not terribly practical.
Not useful, quite.
But I still think we're at the beginning of that.
Great. Jonathan, what's the scene and situation? Because we've seen a growth of this in different, you know, in different city regions, haven't we, elsewhere? You know, they all have their smaller versions, variations on, you know, attempts to provide, you know, more seamless ticketing, ability to go across different, but just give us a sense of stuff.
So what's the state of play? The cities outside London have all the elements that London has.
Yeah.
So there is smart tech cards, there is contactless payment.
Yeah.
There are tickets that you can use on any public transport service. But a bit like Eric Morecambe once said, got all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order. So the problem can be that the ticket you can use in all services is priced uncompetitively compared with the ticket you can only use on Stagecoach or First Group, and which ticket the First Group and Stagecoach promote their own. So you're not necessarily always getting the sum of the parts. And I think that's what you get in London, the overall simplicity. The brand is looking after you. You know what you're getting. So that's what we don't necessarily have in the other city regions. And some of that comes back to what we were talking about earlier around bus deregulation and pounds, all the rest of it. I think the other thing to raise is mobility as a service, which is an ugly phrase for a neat idea.
Yeah.
So the neat idea is that at the moment you can buy essentially a package which will give you access to all public transport services. But what if that would also give you access to taxis, car hire, bike hire, electric bike hire, etc. So it would give you total mobility.
Mm.
Then the argument is more and more people wouldn't need a car. Why would you? Because for the journey you want a private vehicle. Instead of just having one vehicle, you could hire any vehicle. You might want a van to go over the tip rather than your own car.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of talk in the sector at the moment around mobility as a service. But the question is, can you get the pricing right? So will the price for the package be attractive enough for enough people to buy it to get the economies of scale to make it work? So various cities in the UK, Birmingham at the moment has got Wim, Westminster's got Wim, which is an adaptation of something that's happening in Helsinki. So there's that. And I think there's also other issues too about what the role of the public sector is. And going back to our earlier discussion around the job gets harder but more interesting. So say you had mobility as a service offer that was controlled by a taxi company or car companies.
Mm-hmm.
When they gave you journey options, they're going to be tempted to say, well, you probably should get a taxi for that. Whereas the public sector might say, well, why don't you go by bike?
Yeah.
Because of the public health benefits. So there's all sorts of issues around, does the public sector, or does it go, no, this is a new era, we'll stand back. I think what will happen in practice is different cities will take different approaches. Yeah. It'll be more laissez-faire, and some will say, no, we're going to do this, or at least we're going to have a central role.
Mm.
And I think more widely in cities, that's a really interesting question around how cities respond to things like Airbnb and all these other new innovations.
Yeah.
Do you let them rip? Do you try and work with them? Or do you say, we're going to have to take a more assertive role?
And obviously one of the beauties of a more devolved but empowered city region system would be that those city regions could take those decisions that best suit their particular areas or their particular aspirations and attitudes, right?
I think that's absolutely right. And we need to see how different approaches work out.
And how, in terms of that those ideas encapsulated in kind of mobility as a service, are we close to these sort of being rolled out or tested, or are we still in the let's kind of figure it all out stage? Jonathan, and then.
I think the technology is there. It's more about the business models and the governance models, I think. And I think at the moment, I'm not aware, I may be missing something, of a very large mobility service at scale anywhere in the world.
Right.
But everywhere in the world is very interested in it.
Yeah, and so that seems to be the next frontier.
Because of the prize, the big prize.
Yeah.
But it does play to some of these wider, because I think one of the other things going on in transport is there's some very large corporations, as we know, who dominate the internet.
Yeah.
And they have their eyes on transport.
Yes.
And how does business and service play into some of those machinations that are going on at the moment?
Yeah. But TfL and sort of mobility the kind of thoughts around that?
Well, I think we'd argue that we've got some of it already in the payment platform, because you can pay via your Oyster or contactless payment for a wide variety of transport modes. So, you know, rivers, bicycles, you name it. I think one of the things that we have seen in London are some of the new innovators coming in to try and run demand responsive services. And our attitude to that is to take a look at that in a controlled way and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because I think you just have to roll with some of this to see whether or not it works. So if someone, for example, wants to come in as one or two operators have, to run services in areas where their analysis is that our services don't quite do the job. Well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't you at least try and see how it goes? Mm. So I think thinking about mobility as a service is about enabling, in the sense of enabling people to pay for the mode of transport that they need at that moment is a really rather interesting
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
But we've, as Jonathan says, we haven't really seen anyone that's cracked it. It's another one where there's plenty of talk about it and plenty of people have put in venture capital and, you know, some serious money behind trying to make it work.
Mm.
And so, again, it comes back to what the role of the public authority is. Are you an operator? Are you an integrator? Are you an aggregator?
Yeah.
It's interesting stuff. Thing.
Yeah, okay. So let's, in our sort of third segment, or kind of third and final segment, let's just turn a little bit towards, as I say, if we think forwards, you know, we have these sort of conditions that we've talked about, some of the pressures on the system, and some of the long run trends around growth and, you know, and all of the things we have in technology improvements. You know, we have ticketing technology that allows us to, you know, to go further and faster than we have. We have new infrastructure in various ways being put in. But in terms of policy changes or things that our transport authorities need in order to move towards, to achieve a more integrated system, what is it that we would ideally want to be seeing over the, you know, over the relatively near term, Jonathan? Is it crude as saying, you know, transport, big city transport authorities outside of London want, for a starting point, they want everything that London's got. Is it as crude as that? Or is there more to it than that in terms of, you know, what the powers and responsibilities and that they would want? Unpick that and just tell me what they'd want there.
I think that other cities do want more of the levers that London has, but it's not just London, the American cities.
Cities
in Scandinavia, yeah. Germany, Netherlands, just about anywhere in the developed world. I think that we have made progress in terms of things like the bus powers, combined authorities, which are linking planning, economic development, and transport. So that's progress. I think one area where we could do with more, we did have a wave of good progress on rail devolution. And if you ever wanted an example of why devolving more powers is a good idea and works, well, just look at London Overground in London. I mean, it was rubbish under British Rail, and it was rubbish under National Rail privatisation, and it's flipping brilliant now.
Yeah.
And why is that? Well, because it was devolved,
yeah.
And it mattered to London, so London found the money to transform it. And now you see why would you ever have had a such a poor service in a big city like London. And the same is true in Scotland, yeah. And the same is true in Merseyrail Electrics, all transformed since devolution. So we've made some progress on that, but it seems to have stalled a bit.
Yeah.
You're probably aware of the mayor's efforts in London to keep it rolling, and Chris Grayling not being persuaded. But I think the case is so strong that ultimately a Secretary of State will see the benefits and will carry on rolling. So I think there's that. I think there's stuff as well in cities' hands too to coordinate. If you look at some of the things we've been talking around, which play a critical role, taxi licensing, highways. So in London we have strategic highways in TfL's control. In other city regions, the districts are the highways authorities. And if you look at some of the issues we've been talking about, like growth in taxes, I mean that comes back to how you use the road space. What about traffic restraint measures? What about parking? What about curb space?
Yeah.
If you've got more and more deliveries, the curb space becomes more contested. So streets, the future of streets, is going to be important. So these are things that city regions, and they are doing that. There is more coordination and more work on that going on within the city regions to pull that together. Because it comes back, I think, to what I was saying earlier, which is the job has got more harder but more interesting. In the old days, it was about, well, there was probably buses, but that's what we need to do with rail, with trams, and you knew what they were.
Yeah.
And now there's these other things coming in, but also rails, trains can act like trams, and trams can act like buses, and they can be electric powered or diesel powered. So the more the levers you have, to coordinate, the better chance you have of making some of these quite challenging trade-offs yeah. between the modes, between consumer benefit and public benefit, between air pollution and economic growth. But also thinking about some of these things around, I think going back to the technology point, a lot of the transport debate at the moment is very technology driven, all about, wow, look at these autonomous vehicles we may have in the future. But actually, what about the role of technology in reducing air quality? What about the role of technology in dealing with things like social care and social need, about coordinating transport fleets that are currently separately provided for social services, yeah. for healthcare, education. Yeah. There's a lot of technological applications that may not be quite as profitable and glamorous, but again, cities are the ones that will yeah. have the interest, yeah. the public interest, yeah. and also the financial interest, yeah. and there's always some of those challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Vernon, yeah, you know, I mean,
John, the other area where technology really has a role to play is in safety. We haven't really touched on safety. And you know, if you don't run a safe transport service, you have nothing.
No.
And there are still far too many people killed or seriously injured on the road network, for example, in London. And technology, you know, particularly in collisions with buses and so on. So drawing down on technology to help solve some of that. So some of the autonomous vehicle stuff might seem a bit far-fetched, but elements of the autonomous vehicle technology is useful right now
yeah.
to make the road network safer
yeah.
than it currently is.
That is a very good point. So, you know, you mentioned the 80% target in a sense, you know, or as a good peg. What are the additional powers, responsibilities, you know, areas that you know, what's next for TfL in terms of, you know, further integrating and creating a further integrated urban transport system in London?
Well, I think we're very lucky because we've had quite a lot of stuff for 18 years
yeah.
and it's been added to over time. And I think one of the things I would just observe, I mean, I'm on the urban transport group, which Jonathan runs, and it's really interesting talking to colleagues from around the country around the table about the challenges. But the advent of metro mayors in other regions is a game changer. For the first time, there are sort of political focal points
yeah.
to make the case for better services and for continued investment, which is necessary across the whole country, not just in London, not just in Manchester, but across the whole country. So we've had many of those tools for a number of years, but we would like more suburban rail services devolved to us.
Mm.
Not because we just want the logo on the side of it, but because we think we can get greater capacity out of it and you know, introduce some of the things that you do when you're running a metro style service that the National Rail Network doesn't currently have across the board. I have to say, of course, there are massive changes happening on the heavy rail network in and around London, and the new services in and around Thameslink, for example, will run frequencies that aren't too far off,
yeah, for the metro system.
But we do think that there are greater efficiencies and big customer benefits from greater integration.
Mm. We could go on talking about this forever, but my guests today have been Jonathan Bray and Vernon Everett. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.